went to get Clancy. I'm up again, but he did not say anything.
A little applause, I'll get up, if you don't mind. I got a little applause. I don't say it for myself, but it sounds good on the tape. My name is Clancy Emerson again, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here this morning to discuss the following steps. We talked last night about the acceptances, the really non-debatable acceptances. We had trouble drinking, trouble sobriety, and somehow we got to come to believe there's a power here that asks whether we can see it or describe it at a given moment. Thirdly, that we're going to try to make a decision to turn our will and our life over to that power. And that's kind of a nebulous thing unless you can put it in the realm of, well, I'll do what my sponsor says, which is really the basic predicate when you're starting. As you get along sober longer, you have to find more abstractions. It's very difficult. I think perhaps that one of the things that's difficult for people like me when I was new and occasionally now, any problem I talk about I've had in the past, I occasionally have now. That's just how rotten I am. I hear people talk about how they've given up these feelings and just press the right button and they get them right back again. You know, some years ago, there was a guy in our group, he's an old guy that couldn't convince us, and he's taking his second blister case. He looks like Steve Aubrey's blister. I no longer hate anyone. It's wonderful that we find this freedom. That was his sponsor. I've been listening to his diatribe for his thing. I said to the president, I don't know what devil made you do. I said, how about your brother-in-law, Al? He said, that son of a bitch. Every time you think you're free of all emotions, just wait a second. Yeah. I think I mentioned this once a couple of times. I thought that the closest I ever came to being truly spiritual is at the International Convention in Miami Beach in 1970. And it was a very thrilling convention. Bill Wilson was wheeled down the stage and gave his last talk. But again, I don't know why I'm getting off on this kind of stuff, but just interesting little things to me. Bill Wilson, I'd heard him talk several times in the next convention. I'd met him, I sat in his office for an hour in 1963, and I knew him at least as a psychophant. And he came to the Miami Beach Convention. He was the scheduled speaker Friday night. And the guy said, he's too sick. He can't talk. He said, oh, God. They put in some substitute. He said, well, maybe we'll hear him Saturday. But he couldn't hear him Saturday. And I was staying with some friends, an old guy from Pittsburgh. And he'd been sober forever. And he said, listen, kid, Bill Wilson's going to talk. I said, I don't think so. He's pretty sick. Believe me, he's going to talk. I said, I don't think so. Everybody I can talk to talked to people from the World Service Office. They didn't think so. Sunday morning, we're sitting on the speaker, going, and all of a sudden, the guy comes in. Bill Wilson is here. He's going to make an appearance. They wheeled him out. This dying man. He got up. We heard the tape. I started off pretty good. He's full of oxygen. And all of a sudden, he ran out of oxygen. And like this, slumped back in his chair. He had tubes in his nose. They wheeled him away. He died shortly thereafter. But I said to this old guy, this old fool, John, I said, John, how did you know that Bill was going to talk? Are you some sort of a mystic? Is that your thing? I said, no, I just happen to know that human beings are human beings. And Bill Wilson would never want it said that Dr. Bob talked while he was dying and Bill Wilson didn't. So we're dealing with people with human emotions. But so the point is, why are we, with all our emotions, why are we going to go into these next things? And I find over the years, as I mentioned last night, I had a very difficulty with a higher power, because a higher power to me, if it were a God, was, if not vengeful, at least avenging. If a God who did not really want well for me, but wanted to give me justice. And that's one of the things you learn as you get older in the world, is when you're young, easy to say, justice. We want justice for the underprivileged. We want justice for all mankind. And especially justice for me. If you haven't got enough for them, give it to me. But as you get older, you realize you really don't. The cry becomes, mercy, mercy, mercy. I've had all the justice I can handle. So we try not to seek too much justice. But the problem I had with the higher power was that it's a difficulty, because what we're really seeking here, hopefully, is, I don't know what it is I'm seeking, but it's got to be something more than not drinking. I know how to do that. I went to the Texas Insane Asylum finally, because I stayed sober too long once, and I finally wound up committing suicide. I tried to help my wife through her pregnancy, and I stayed sober until I couldn't stand it, and one day they were all gone from the house, and I just pulled the car in the garage, turned the motor, and went to sleep. I couldn't stand it. So there's got to be something more than not drinking. After I was sober a little while, a few years, I remember talking to new people about why their belief in a higher power, how many believe in a higher power. And somehow or other, they got talking about how I had come, I'd never even thought about it, but how I had come to believe in a higher power. And which enabled me to continue to try to stay around AA. The big problem I had with the belief in a God, I suppose, was that God is a very selective thing. You hear that all the time before you. God was with me and wanted me to stay sober. How about all the people who are not sober? I guess that implies God does not want them to stay sober. In other words, it's as though you can stay sober, you too can't. You can. No. Yeah, you know, if that's the way God operates, I'm not going to be one of the select, I have a feeling. You out. Or just a gesture. Those of you listening to this tape, I'm sure you missed that gesture. It was beautiful. Could you hear somebody somewhere saying, I listened to all this crap, but the only good thing was the gesture, and I missed that. What is difficult except about God is that God, if rewards and punishes, I must be punished because I have not been a good man, and I've been evil and I've been a sinner. And I find over the years, little by little, as I took actions and did these things little by little, I guess in retrospect, what I came to understand, had to accept, the most difficult premise in a higher power is that if God exists, and if he is what people say he is, then he must be the same to everybody. We talk about God, the grace of God. Is the grace of God a selective thing? Do some people get it and some don't? It's nothing I can depend on. What makes it unusual is that I think you come to believe that God's grace, hopefully you can accept, falls on everybody. Like the rain in Shakespeare falls on the just and the unjust. God's grace falls on everybody. But how can you accept that? Then why, when I go to work in the morning, with God's grace, am I stepping over the bodies of people who are dying, and they also have God's grace? How can that be? And the analogy, I guess, that came to me early in my sobriety that began to help me overcome this was that it came to me little by little. I could conjecture it with a television transmitter. Television transmitter, on the day of the Grey Cup, sends out a clear, sharp picture of the game to every receiver in Canada. A sharp, clear picture and perfect. A lot of people don't even have their TVs turned on. Some of them have old TVs and they get funny pictures. Some of them don't even know there's a football game going on. Some of them who get the picture don't know how to dial it in. I began to equate God's grace with that TV picture. God's grace, or to put it in a different way, call it peace of mind, call it whatever you will, it implies that there's, God means good for me. He wants things to be good for me. He's not going to do them for me, but God means good for me. And he sends me forth a picture of good. But many,
I didn't even know it's there. Now, this television analogy, my TV set at home. I like to watch football games, and I have little grandsons who come racing through the room from time to time. There are always new ones, it seems like. And I can just turn my head, and they'll have those knobs turned in no time. And I turn back, there are blue people going. Now, the nice thing anybody learns, that's got any common sense, is that you learn there are dials that you, I don't have to know how they work. I know horizontal hold, when the thing's going, that's vertical hold, I guess, I turn it and it stops it. Once around here, horizontal hold, many times pulls it back. When the faces are blue, you turn the pin. And little by little, the sound is funny, you get it back on. I don't have to know the theory of the electrons racing through the some kind of a tube in there, a microchip. You know, nonsense. I just have to turn the damn knob. But I can get a picture up to the... Now, I think that God is sending out this picture. Like, you're sending out the picture of that football game. And the picture is not of a great puppet called peace of mind, or grace, or inner harmony, whatever you want to call it. And it goes to everybody. And it doesn't care whether you got a Mitsubishi TV set, or a GE, or... So, your picture may have difficulty coming in, but the picture is there. Now, it seems to me, what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, it has taught me to use certain dials to get that picture. The picture is there whether I get it or not, but it taught me to use certain dials. Now, AA doesn't give me tools like a vertical hold that I can understand. That prayer, that knob is marked prayer. I don't understand if it works or not. I've been praying intensely, some degree of intensity, for over three decades. And I couldn't tell you today for sure that any prayer I've ever said got anywhere. I would like to think it did, but I don't know. But the heavens didn't open and say, okay. But I know this, when I turn that knob, the picture gets a little clearer. That's why. Other knobs are not marked color, tints, horizontal hold. They're called love, or service, or doing something for someone you don't have to. Things that really don't seem to have any application, but they don't have to. I don't have to know why they work. When I do them, the picture gets clearer. But unfortunately, I'm a human being, and I'd rather just have the picture stay that way. Now, once you get a clear picture, which I've had a few times, a lot of times when I think about it, you think, now it should just stay like that. Now, what's the big deal? Somehow it seems as though our TV sets are on the back of pickup trucks. Every time you get a picture, incessant tuning. You just get tired of it. I'll learn to live with them like this. To hell with it, you know. I decline to get out of my easy chair to walk to that TV set one more time. That's too much. But I could accept that analogy. It has satisfied me intellectually and emotionally that God's grace does fall on all of us. It is now incumbent upon me to take actions to bring that picture. And it's never going to be perfect and stay perfect. Because unfortunately, I am a fallible receiver. I have to be very careful sometimes that I do not base my life on direct messages from God. Because the messages are right, but my receiver's wrong. I remember I was relatively new. God once upon a time told me to quit my job and punch the guy on the way out. And now it's over almost 2 years as well. But I will be done, Father. Later on, upon reflection, I think the message was, do not quit your job and punch the guy and went. But the receiver missed the do not. That's why it's always a little dangerous to operate on the basis of direct messages from God. That's why many times people who live on the basis of direct messages from God wind up in insane asylums. That's why we have to surround them by doing things. But But it seems to me, once we've come to a position at AA, where we've made the acceptance that something's wrong and I can't do anything about it, and there may be something here that can, now the next six steps that we deal with are all ways of clearing up some of the static. That's all. Just ways of clearing up the static, the transmission, in the channels, to open up the channels, to get competing problems out of the way, to get the snow off, or at least as much snow off the screen as you can. And we cannot work on them individually. That's one of the great problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to say, I'd like to work on my guilt, I'd like to work on my fear, I'd like to work on my relationships. But it's very difficult to do that, because it all comes from a basic mishmash. It's like a ice cube container in the refrigerator, you know. There are some ice cube containers that are made of plastic, but you can just make two ice cubes. Okay, that's all you fill up. You work with those two ice cubes. But unfortunately, the one I have, and I suppose most of us, is the old metal kind, where you put in enough water for two ice cubes, you don't have two ice cubes. You just have a 1/16 of an inch all over the whole pan. There's no way to do this easily, so you have to work on everything little by little. And it really is a drag. But once you begin to understand that, you'll realize you're not going to find big spiritual nirvanas no matter how hard you cram between now and 3 o'clock this afternoon. It's just going to be a long, endless process. And I think that's the fourth step. There's one that most of us would accept as where you begin to take these actions. Up to then, it is the first three steps, I think, you must take again and again. And you take them every time you go to a meeting. You take them every time you listen to your sponsor. And you take them on and on. Because their intellect does not get you better. You have to alter emotional reactions and perceptions. And in my experience, I would never have anyone take an inventory early on in their sobriety. They don't have enough. That's what's wrong in many times of when people think they've taken their inventory in a treatment facility. I know they take the 12 steps, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it certainly is not the end-all of the 12 steps, because you can't take 12 steps, these 12 steps in 28 days, or 28 weeks, or 28 months, or 28 years, really. Because there's always something going on, but if you take an inventory after 5 or 10 days of sobriety, you get one of two things. You either get an inventory that says, well, there's really nothing wrong with me, I drank too much, and now I'm sober, and it's just fine, thanks. Or else you get inventory that says, everything that's ever happened in the world is my fault. I was responsible for the flood. And both of them are equally inaccurate. That's what you get when you have no, you're operating on just reaction, alcoholic reaction, perception. I think those are the two great underlying causative factors of alcoholism. In alcoholic emotions are pride and guilt. Pride is a compensation for feeling less than. I don't know very many alcoholics who really have pride, but they develop a compensatory pride to disguise their feeling not enough. So you come to write a fourth step in AA, and you have to be sober a little while. You have to have enough security to admit how insecure you are. It's a funny thing. When you're insecure, you can't really admit you're totally insecure. You have to be somewhat secure. You have to have something to stand on while you discuss the flood that's swirling around you. And so you take the inventory. It has been said that this is why they separate the men from the boys. I suppose it is one of two steps. Bill, in the 12 and 12, describes the sixth step as the step that truly separates the men from the boys. And there's something to be said for that. But here, I would suppose in practicality, more people have balked at the fourth step than at any other step. That's where they stop. That's where they change. That's where it all begins to look different. And yet we must take this, even though it seems to have no immediate application, and seems to be a very painful thing to do. I want to work on individual things. I want to work on my relationship to my children. I want to work on how I can get along with the world. I want to work on I don't want to work on just continually opening up things I've spent years to try to forget. But it goes back to that same old concept here. You cannot work on specific things very well when you are in a shambles. You must build a foundation somewhere. I was thinking of that analogy that I used to tell of years ago. In my backyard, there's a lemon tree. And sometimes it's a big lemon tree, and it gets very dry because we live in a desert. Sometimes that lemon tree needs watering badly. Based upon my perception of how to take care of things, I would watch a lemon shrivel a little bit, and I'd get my ladder and go up and give it a little water. And here's another one over here. Jesus, is there no end to this? Fall off the ladder, and some boob comes along and says, why don't you just water the trunk? Because there's nothing wrong with a trunk. The trunk is fine. That baby up there. And that's the way I've handled problems all my life. There's nothing wrong with a trunk. It's just a series of stinking lemons. They're just making me crazy. So there has to be some subrogation of my own wisdom to begin to work on things generally. And writing an inventory is a rather strong beginning. And it, you know, sometimes you get to writing an inventory is a painful thing. I hear people sometimes surprised that they have taken the fourth step and it really didn't make me feel better. It's not supposed to make you feel better. It's supposed to make you feel worse. When you write down what a crap head you really are, that's not liable to make you elated. Oh, wonderful. I just discovered I'd like to twist baby chicken's neck. And there's a school, I mean, people, Catholics, who say, I do that in the confessional. I don't need to do it. I told my sponsor, I don't need to do it. I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist for many thousands of dollars. Why should I take it with an out-of-work actor? Well, as usual, he got testy. He's always getting testy. Something about everybody I know always got testy. I don't know why. And I told him I wasn't going to take an inventory. And like most people, I was prevailed upon to take it. Not by my sponsor so much, but just by the day I was going to commit suicide. A little pain here and there. I remember that day where I'd been sober about 6 months, and somebody put in some clout for me and got me a job as a dishwasher. That gives you a feeling of confidence to know that you need intervention to get a job as a dishwasher. I thought he'd him. I've been on the faculty of the University of Texas. Just do the goddamn dishes. Shut up. I did pretty well for a while, but after about 2 days, I've been very keen as to when I'm being used. I can see that. It became obvious to me little by little that the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out. So I began to deduce these little pukes are getting dishes from other restaurants to humiliate me because I'm an Anglo. So I didn't do a lot of them, I just put them aside. The ones that seemed to be overflow. And at the end of the day, I had quite a good collection. The manager's actually doing this. I said, no, that's a damn bus boy taking back on behind it. Those Mexican guys are really screwing you around. Well, turned out that I had miscounted. They were all our dishes, and he said, I'm going to have to let you go. I said, let me go? Then you have to go to the overdrive, you know. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not implied, not saying I didn't want to be, I just said I was, and I'm trying to find a new life, and I'm working 12 wonderful steps, and it's a whole, you know, you do all the things. He said, I don't care about that. You just don't wash enough goddamn dishes. And he fired me, and I left. I thought about that many, many times since. I'll tell you, there's been a lot of times in my life, in much different milieus, I maybe have been up late at night as he's helping somebody in the hospital at 2 in the morning. And it doesn't seem to me that I should have to go to work and be in that office, that advertising agency, at 9 the next morning, along with the same people who just went to bed or watched television, did nothing. I'm giving so much more. There should be some special treatment for me. And I hear that guy's voice. They don't care what your story is. We just want you to wash the dishes. They don't care at work whether I sit in the hospital. They just want me to come at 9 o'clock and do my job. We sometimes use AA as an excuse not to live in the world. AA is designed to help me live more comfortably in the world, not as a withdrawal from it. So how do you remember? When all else fails, I remember I want to do something. Just do your dishes. They just want you to do your dishes. Shut up. You can't really state when people are looking, because it looks funny when you just say, shut up, shut up. Sometimes you just have to do with mind. But that day I decided, it had been sober 6 months, I couldn't hold a job as a dishwasher, I decided to kill myself. And I never been in pain much. I had no car to drive to put on take carbon dioxide, which isn't a bad way to go, I might say. So I decided to walk in the ocean, because I was been rather dramatic. I was set in my mind that A Star is Born, Frederick March, walking in the ocean. And they're all sorry later to know. But we looked, poor Norman, Maine. So I started to walk to the ocean, and I hadn't been there walking, and I walked and walked, and that's a big town. I was in Beverly, eastern end of Beverly Hills. I walked and walked and walked, and I couldn't find the ocean. I was walking that dramatic, maybe you've done this if you're depressed, and sometimes you walk through the streets when you're really depressed, and you just know that you're like Hamlet walking the battlements at Elsinore. It's just your tragic figure, and people must be looking at you saying, oh, what a tragic and wonderful figure. What a terrible load he must carry. It really doesn't strike me what you're saying. Did you see that asshole? But he walked, and I walked. I couldn't find the ocean. I finally stopped at the gas station. I said, where's the ocean? There's the western end of Beverly Hills. You have to walk past the Veterans Hospital, and then another 3 miles. I said, well, I don't mind dying, but I'm not going to walk 5 miles. So I realized I'd walked into my sponsor's fare zone, toll zone. It only cost 10 cents from there, so I decided to give him a call. I hate to call him, because he didn't like bad news. I discovered that over the years. Made him testy. But I called him, I said, I'm just gonna. What I'll do? I'll try to touch his heart. I'll tell him. I used to be a good writer once upon a time. Well, I'll tell him a story that'll be so sad even his heart will ring. He'll come and be at your side, son. Hello, this is Clancy. Why don't you work in just a minute, Bob? I tell you, there's something you don't really realize. I lost my kids, and my family, and my home. My parents have ripped me off. I'll probably never work in my field again. And I know that, Bob, but that isn't what I want to talk to you about. There's something you don't know about. You know, even inside of AA, Bob, there's something different about me. And I've been here 6 months. I've been going to meetings every night. But even here, people treat me different. They realize there's something different about me. I'm not, when they go to parties, and I think they don't tell me. They go off by themselves. After meeting, they go and have coffee. Stumble onto them, they say, sit down, but begrudgingly, but they don't invite me. When I sit down in a club, talk to someone, they find any reason to get up and go to a different table. I never get called on a participant. If you get called on once, I tell them how I feel, and I never get called on again. Bob, there's something terribly wrong with the AA doesn't seem to be accepting me. And it suddenly struck me, this is true. The worst story I could think of was mine. And I don't know about others, but it touched me so much I burst into tears. I said, Bob, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I figured you have to hear my sponsor. Why don't you write your goddamn inventory the way I told you? And I just explained to him why I didn't. I said, in my judgment, Bob, writing it, I've told you this before, writing an infographic doesn't help people like me. I'm already consumed with guilt and despair writing and thinking of myself can't help, Bob, in my judgment. That's the one last thing in the world. I said, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car. If I wanted your judgment, I should have put my head in the back window and ask you for it. Well, I've been living in a big house in Pacific Palisades. Who cares how it looks to you? I'll tell you. My sponsor was rather peremptory, I'm sorry to say. He did not know much about sponsorship. Several times I thought in that first year, that was one of the times, that's it. If I had the money, I would call up the World Service Office in New York and have this man stopped. I could just visualize myself. I just want you to know, there's an old timer in Los Angeles killing newcomers. And I'll give you his name, address, and phone number. I never had the money to do it, unfortunately. Now it's many years later, 37 years later. When I talk to the World Service Office, it's all different. I say, no, I'm not. I've been on both sides of this equation, and I'd rather be on this side. I'd rather be the one sleeping and let somebody else lay awake and think about me. Someday I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill him someday. By that day, he made me so upset in a fit of absolute craziness. I came out of that telephone booth. Thank God I turned left, but I turned right, and I made the ocean in 2 bounds. I got to go, give me the paper, I've let my fingers go. That's just crazy. I wrote things that I would never tell anybody. In fact, what my sponsor told me the week before, he said, get right in the inventory, put in things you don't tell your psychiatrist. Put in everything. And I told my psychiatrist everything. And after all, I hadn't told my psychiatrist anything. You think I'm going to spend that much money to tell a guy something that's going to make him reject me? Get out of my office, you sick son of a bitch. I told him what he needed to know. And firstly, he couldn't do it. He didn't have enough ability to handle it. So I wrote this inventory of things in which I wasn't the hero at all. Oh, God, hideous things. Terrible things. I got all done with that. Boy, I had a little terrible feeling when I realized what a filthy thing I was. But I had a little feeling of relief, too. Because I'd written this inventory, and despite what that old fool said, it didn't make me all feel all that much better. I proved writing an inventory didn't work, and that cheered me up. I didn't have what you call a good attitude. About a week later, I stayed in this depression for a week, and I was about to commit suicide again, and I said, I guess I'd better read it to the old fool. I read you this inventory. I said, all right, about time. So he took me in his car. We rode along the ocean for 40 miles to Oxnard. And he gave me a flashlight and a piece of paper. And I read this. It was a little easier moving in the dark, I'll tell you that, than sitting looking at him, which he knew. And I read this, and I did the same, I'm sure, which I've heard some time since. Same thing. You know, it's a good inventory when they start off by saying, now, before I read this part, let me explain it. Never mind explaining, just read it. And you read, there'll be a little teardrop. And we got up near Austin, and I thought, he's going to make me get out of his car. Right? I didn't realize how rotten it was until I got almost done with it. I looked over and he's going, oh. I pushed him over the edge. We may go into a crash. That's a funny thing. Since then, I've taken that ride maybe 200 times on the other side, driving, while some other little puke has been over there to fly. Now, let me explain this. And I've always been a much better listener than my sponsor was. I always turn my head when I yawn. There's only so many things you can do with your mind and body, and for years I've wished God, I hope you have something good in that inventory. Something new. Just something to break up the hideous monotony. And they never do. I don't tell them that, but I wish it, you know. Isn't there something new? After a while, you just get to see your patterns. Because you're all, humans are remarkably the same down at that level. Alcoholics are, you know. We almost have. You tell me they left something. Didn't you leave something out there? You were talking to that bitch? No? But that is usually followed by that. And on and on. But I wrote an inventory. My sponsor shared his weaknesses with me, much to my surprise. And as a result of that, I felt better. And I, later on, looking in the book, discovered it in the big book, Bill Wilson talks about once you've taken this step, if you have left nothing out, you kind of walk on a big highway with God, hand in hand. I think this morning, I'm glancing, chapter 5, in the step 5, in the 12 and 12, he writes a good description of this feeling. Provided you hold back nothing, your sense of relief will mount from minute to minute. The dammed up emotions of yours break out from their confinement and miraculously vanish as soon as they are exposed. As the pain subsides, a healing tranquility takes its place. And when humility and serenity are so combined, something else of great moment is bound to occur. Many an AA, once agnostic or atheist, tells us that it was during this stage of step 5 that he actually felt the presence of God. And I believe that to be literally true, because there's been so much jammed up and dammed up. And you know that of yourself, as long as it stays within you, it is completely out of perspective. I think that's the secret of all of AA. Every time you talk about something, every time you write about something, it is never so horrible, because once it gets outside of you, it becomes a finite thing. I'm sure most of you have experienced it before. You just tell somebody that's just something, just making you crazy, and shortly thereafter, it was just another thing. Small, finite thing with finite answers. But the fourth and fifth step is an easy step to understand how it works after you have done it. But before you do it, it is always very difficult, because we can all always say, well, it wasn't anything. But to every individual, it means this. I must expose things that I am not confident there's anyone else like me. And you say, how do I write an inventory? What do I put down? Big thing, the mechanics of, you don't pay much attention, but the mechanics of writing an inventory. Now, the big book has this thing on fear, resentment, written in 1938. And we've become, well, I'm not putting that down, but we've become much more sophisticated since then. We understand there's a lot more that we have to deal with in fear and resentment. And the tendency sometimes to put down long, just a hideous 88 pages of self-obsessed biography, autobiography. Some people just write a few sentences and on. And it's very difficult. One of the things that I've listened to a lot of inventory and I have sponsored a lot of people over the years, which incidentally, talk about step 12, but sponsorship to me is the most valuable single tool in all of AA, primarily because when I'm thinking about that sick puke, I'm not thinking about this sick puke. That's like a paid vacation in the country, yeah. But I have, over the years, I have devised to, I'm not certainly superimposing myself over any authority in the field, but for my purposes, I've devised 7 questions that I give to people that I believe when they answer it thoroughly, when I've written a good inventory, as I understand it. And the questions, I mean, there's all sorts of ways to do this. I mean, Hazel didn't put out a book that you cannot finish if you live with 2 lives, you know. Just, and there are some people who seem to be rather prurient. Their whole outline on fifth step is sex. It's just as though, tell me some more about that. Call me up at home. Hey, it's somewhere not quite like that. It is a big step, but it's only one or two. I'm just one step and another step, that's all. No more and no less important than the others, but they do have an integral part. Because we've agreed now to change, try to follow AA's ways. Now we have to identify what the hell we have to work on. And that's all. to get up some of the crap that we've hidden all our lives. And most of us know that. And the questions I have devised, which I give to people, and seems to work well, and I'm certainly not recommending them to anybody else, but one, is looking back over your life, what memories are still painful, are still guilt-ridden, are still dirty? Sometimes the answer to that one goes for 20 pages. Sometimes for one page. Two, in what ways do you today, do you feel inadequate as a person? Three, who do you resent and why? Be as specific and nasty as you can. Four, what do you conceive to be the ongoing problems in your human relationship? What seems to carry through your human? So everywhere you go, there always seems to be the same kind of reaction. Five, what do you consider to be your defects of character as you see them? Six, what would you say today is your goal in life, whether realistic or not? Seven, how do you think AA can in any way possibly help you to start towards any of these goals? Now, it doesn't sound very complex, but people write long answers to those questions, and they start writing, because the biggest problem is to really get the pencil on the paper. Once you start writing, it gets a little easier. Just getting that pencil on the paper to have something to write. Oh, yes, I understand that. Well, I'm guilty. And as they write, it starts to come out. I think one of the ways you know they've written a good inventory is when they're reading it, they start to cry at the enormity of it. They're not even cry, you know, but just to choke up a little bit. It gives me a divine thrill when someone's reading their inventory and they choke up because they've written something they have buried so long they can't imagine they're reading it. And as a result of that, of course, to have a chance to write. And there's nothing really very new. There are new specifics, but not new underlying problems. Has always been my concept of this theory, that the underlying problems are really the same. The things that underlie, seems to be every fifth step I've heard, always gets back to those two main things. Lack, feeling less than, accompanied by false pride, together with guilt. And these things make us take actions that we would not ordinarily take. We have to defend, we have to prove, we have to overcompensate, we have to take these actions. And little by little, we live in just a tangled web. It is not going to change the fact that you were in jail while your son died. I remember that's one of the things I could not bear to look at. I put it in my inventory. I swore I'd never tell it to his soul. It was just so hideous to me. And I've mentioned thousands of talks since, and talked to people who've lost their children. Now, there's nothing in my inventory that's going to make me, what my sponsor says, going to undo that. My son's grave is going to be there, and I'll have been in jail and feel as though I caused his death. That's how I felt. But as a result of the inventory, I began to realize I did not cause his death. It's a natural phenomenon. It's a fact of existence, but there are ways it need never happen again. And that then is then and now is now. And sometimes I think one of the great things about AA, it makes me look back at many of the things I've done, almost as though they were done by a mentally retarded brother. Someone who's doing the best, really, someone who was really doing the best he could but had no tools to do it. Just stumbled and went from crisis to tragedy to crisis to tragedy and never understood why. Just no cause and effect in any way. And I think that's the great value of the fourth and fifth step, you begin to realize that these are not singularly evil things you've done. They're natural results of people who stumble and don't know what they're doing. I believe that at any given moment in life, everybody thinks they're doing as best they can. I always believe that. That's what makes problems in international relationships. You know, we keep saying, well, we're fighting Hitler, good against bad. But Hitler feels he's fighting the United States, good against bad. Everybody feels they're right. People always feel they're right, and they can justify why I'm right and you are wrong. They talk about the terrible pogroms and the
terrible Holocaust in Europe, millions of Jewish people. How could anybody assume that's right? Because the Jewish people have for centuries ruined our country. We must rid ourselves of them, and if they won't leave voluntarily, they must be exterminated for the good of the world. Everybody feels they're right. I mean, the great battles of the medieval times, armies fighting, both of them to convince the other one, my approach to love and God is better than your approach to love and God. Great armies wheeling and marching around through Central Europe, and the Crusades. So it isn't a matter of feeling that you're right, it's trying to find a better knowledge of how to go about things. And in the fourth and fifth step, I have made truly the first major surrender of my sobriety. I surrendered, I said, yes, I drink too much, and I'm sober too much, and I can't stay sober, and I don't like drinking, and life is terrible, and maybe there's a power here, and I'm going to try to surrender to it. But I actually operated on that power. And I think you must have some security to do this, because no one is going to expose themselves like that if they have, without having some hope that there's a reason for it, because I can't see the reason. In other words, voluntarily, I must do something that I've spent my life trying to not do. I must open my armor and make myself vulnerable. Now, one of the things, one of the little mechanics in AA, is that who do you take this fifth step with? Now, where I live, it is rather common, I don't know if it's good or bad, but take with your sponsor. And people say, where's your sponsor? Gets drunk and talks about you. I don't think anybody cares about you. Your fifth step isn't all that wonderful, really, but I can remember a lot of things people did. I just can't remember who did them. You know. If I could, I'd be a rich man today. It really is rather strange. In the book, it says maybe you want to go to a clergyman or a complete stranger. I would much rather take my chances with my sponsor than a complete stranger. I don't know what he's going to do with it at all. Oh, you say you're with the star and the globe? Oh. But it's kind of an interesting thing. I'm willing to trust my sponsor with the direction to save my life, but I don't want him to know what's wrong with me. I'm going to impress him. I have to keep telling people, all right, stop trying to impress me. Sponsors automatically know you're a fool. That's the one person who does. You have to impress him. He knows you're a fool. We can work from there. Oh, yeah, I guess that. Trying to impress your sponsors. The way you impress your sponsor is taking actions and doing things whether you want to or not. I remember when I thought, oh, a few years sober, my sponsor died, and I got this other sponsor, this spiritual giant, whom I hated, but he was the most active man that I ever knew in the world, the most dedicated, so I had to be my sponsor. And I couldn't, he didn't want to discuss much of anything with me, really. He just wanted to know what I was doing. And I, year after year, took actions and did things to win his approval. And said I worked hard to do it, then I did it. But that did more for me than all the abstract information in the world. Just watching him smile and say, you've done a good job. Oh, hell, anyone could have done it. It has a reverse side, though. Sometimes be tired. You come home from work. And, geez, it's Friday night. And I'm home with my family. I'm 10 years sober. I'm working a big tragedy. A lot of pressure. It's Friday night. I see my calendar. Let's go speak in Oakdale, which is 90 miles north. And the freeway is jammed. It's a hot summer night. And there's about 20 people in the meeting, and they just are like wax figures. And yeah, it's just hideous. I'd rather sit home and talk to a painting, you know. And I called my sponsor. I said, Chuck, I said, don't misunderstand. I'm very grateful that he's done for me, but geez, you know, I'm out all the time. And it's tonight's Friday night, and some of my kids want to go to the show, and Oakdale up there is 90 miles. It's just too hot. The traffic's too bad going out of town. Wouldn't you think it'd be all right to call him and say, get another speaker close by? He said, well, son, I tell you what, I can't talk to you right now. I have to leave early because I have to go to Lake Arrowhead, which is 110 miles away. Can't talk to those 8 people up there, but if you call me in the morning, we'll talk about it. That's the day you feel like saying, I think he's about served his purpose as my family. And the great criticism of Chuck C. is he does too much. He pushes himself too hard. But he always felt better than the people who were criticizing him. There's a moral there somewhere, but I can't make out what it is. Almost as though action is the magic word. But anyway, fourth and fifth step, quite obviously, is a great turning spot. And I think that since I'm allowed to change the format any way I want to, I think we ought to stop now for 15 minutes and have a cup of coffee. Good idea. Good idea. Not all of us are used to living in this kind of climate. I grew up in northern Wisconsin, but it was even colder than it is here, but since I discovered there were warmer places, I left. Anyway, what we thought we would do, our charming chair lady, chairperson, might be a good idea. What we're going to do for the rest of the morning is take up step six. But first of all, here we spend a few minutes on discussion of the steps we just talked about, four and five, if you'd like. If you have any discussion or want to vent a feeling or ask a question or do whatever you like to do, come. Otherwise, I'll just talk incessantly. Incidentally, I would say in passing, I had not intended to put those on the board. I didn't think you'd be deaf with prose, but a couple of people at the break asked me if I'd write them down. So that's what it's about. And I'm not think they are better or worse than anything else. They're just something I've used successfully over the years. And it gets people going. Anybody discussion on steps four and five? Yes, sir, Derek. I know it's a funny name, but try not to laugh. You'll ruin your self-image. Yes, go ahead.
I'm sure in front of us, I got it. We're going. I love it. My name's Derek, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Derek.
I just wanted to comment and say thank you again, as I had in the break, not only for writing down the seven impressions that you asked, but for seeing that by writing it down, we make the mumble jumble of our head finite, and there's such a wrestle with why it works, and you put it clearly, and thank you for that, because with something finite, I can deal one day at a time, I can get into action. And it's just floating around in the head.
Right. Thank you, Derek. They asked me to repeat questions because they can't hear them as you say it. And I really find hard to repeat that statement, just that he thanked the speaker for being wonderful. Well, he wouldn't want me to lie on tape. Right. Yes, sir. Hi, Tom.
I took my fourth and fifth about a year and a half into my sobriety, and I took it because I thought I was going to go crazy. But, you know, I procrastinated a long time. I had that guy in the fourth step from my carry around his ability, and fortunately I didn't use it because he came over to these guys in the fourth step and went crazy. But anyway, I did it. I was sort of a mountain of the greatest. I took a few days off working. Anyway, I gave it my best shot. And it was an emotional experience for the second. But I had never done it since. I talked to my friends in AA, and they said, oh, well, I just did my 12th, fourth step. Well, what makes me feel guilty? Do you believe in taking the fourth step over and over and over and over again?
Question is, some people in AA take a fourth step over and over again. I'm just repeating for the tape. And some people don't. Well, my personal opinion, that's all I speak for, of course, is that nowhere in the literature that I've read or the experience I've seen does it talk about a continuing fourth step. In my opinion, that can easily turn into an ongoing, socially acceptable self-obsession. That's my opinion. I know people in AA who just can't wait to, every time they have a problem, to get home and write about it. I get up and write about it. They can never do anything about it, but they can write about it. And I think we have there may be a case for a second, fourth step further into your sobriety as things surface that you didn't have in your first, fourth step. But for the ongoing business of living, that's why we have a tenth step. And we're supposed to deal with it then and correct it, not let it build up until I can finally vomit it out in another fourth step. But I guess there's no right way to do it, but I know of nothing in AA or experience of Bill Wilson or anybody else that would suggest there's an ongoing series of fourth steps, in my opinion. And I secretly feel the opinion of Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob in heaven. That's only our opinion. Anything? Any other?
How can you tell the difference between an ongoing fourth step and an ongoing tenth step?
Tenth steps are supposed to be ongoing. Fourth steps, I think as he refers to it, well, let me repeat this for the tape. What's the difference between an ongoing fourth step and an ongoing tenth step? An ongoing fourth step is a fourth step position where you sit down and write at length and so on, and you take a fifth step with a sponsor or with someone else. And then a tenth step is where you, at the end of each day, you examine how you're going, what you've been, you balance what you're doing, and reinforce. The difference between, fourth step, it's an enormous thing where you get the truck going. And a tenth step is as you steer it. You've got to keep steering all the time. If you don't like that analogy, I'll think of another one. Yeah, not bad. I'll just chop that down too. I'm certainly glad I came to this meeting. I needed it. I can't read that. Yes, ma'am.
In the big book, when you talk about the fourth step,
yep,
it says that business that doesn't pay any employees is serving it for a business.
Yep.
And a business, if you draw that analogy, you don't do this.
Sorry.
I found for myself that I needed to do this several times as I've grown more aware or gotten to know myself a little better, that I've needed to deal with some of these emotions.
Well,
in the tenth step, I mean, I'm admitting or, you know, promptly admitting that I've done something or that I've felt something, but I'm not necessarily going to my sponsor and saying, oh, here's this revelation. I feel like this about myself.
Well, there's that point of view. As I say, I would have no exception to whatever works for people. And in my opinion, I've seen people take too big inventory. But I also know people have carried it so far that they write inventories incessantly. They're no, you know, so they cannot function in the world. They just can't wait to get home and write about every time they have a feeling. Human feelings, you can't, it's an endless job to keep writing, well, I had this feeling, I had rage today. We all had rage today, for Christ's sake, you know. The point is it something that's really deep, or is it just something made me upset? Common sense. Well, I don't like to hear that kind of talk. I've sunk pretty low, but I haven't sunk to that point. Anything else? Yes, ma'am. Oh, I want to be President of the United States. I want to be a movie star. I want to be a millionaire. I mean, in other words, you might not put down goals that you thought were unrealistic, but put down whatever they are. Just really, it's the but these two really have nothing to do with the inventory. They just are lead-ins into the next, to lead them into the next steps. Why we want to start doing the things, because all of these steps from three on, all of these.
I can't read that here. I'm just asking you what it was. Now, care on the
football. Well, it's just the answer to happy sobriety. I'm sorry, you'll never find out. formula men have been searching for 10,000 years. And you forgot your glasses. Isn't that the way it always goes? But I think it's safe to say that none of these steps that they're to be taken right, they all must be in addition to the power greater than ourselves. We must have the security of that in order to do it well, although we may not consciously aware of it. Otherwise, it just gets down to self-will and self-pride, and that isn't enough, because it obscures it. And everything we can do to help reinforce the idea that a power greater than myself is helping me, giving me a little security to do this. I don't think it's possible, unless you surrender to the fact there's a power greater than yourself. I don't see how you can write a successful fourth step. I don't see how you can do anything, make an unpleasant demand. Can't do anything that's really worthwhile unless you feel you are surrendering something. Because based on my judgment, I wouldn't do that. That's not what I would do. That would not be considered type of therapy that I need for my problem, as I whine to my sponsors. You know, God, I'm so full of pain and guilt now. What I've done, why should I rip? You know, it's like ripping open scabs. Some of them are maybe healed a little bit. Oh, there's one that almost healed. Here, gotcha. Yeah, you know, ripping open these same things. Yet it turns out that's how you get rid of it, to get it out of self. And the fifth step, of course, is to, when you take it with yourself, you do it as you write it and read it. You take it with God. That's relatively easy, but it's very difficult to take it with another human being. That's where the humbling experience in the step comes, I suppose. That's humiliating, but it's to, you affirm what you have done. You affirm what you've done when you do it with somebody else. There are two steps where they talk about, there really is a great feeling of relief following these steps. One is the fifth step, because you've done it with someone else. One is the ninth step, where you've done it with other people. When you're doing it with others, when you're getting out of self. And it seems to me, for self-obsessed people, all of us, any exercise of AA is always getting out of self, getting out of self. Because self-obsession, just left untended, comes right back in constantly. I think there's an interesting, again, this is really highly basic, oversimplified, but it's true, I think. One of the things that enables human beings to survive in the world, probably the most important thing that we are born with, is a sense of self-preservation. And that's what enables the species to survive, the sense of self-preservation. Without that, we would not survive. And we're born, all of us are born into a world that is an ideal world, where we are the focus of the entire universe. Unfortunately, we're too little to enjoy it. But you know, when a baby lies here, he gets hungry, he goes, oh, baby's hungry, here. They don't say, get a job, you little son of a bitch. When you wet your pants, mothers can tell the difference in those cries, fathers can't. I fed a lot of kids with wet pants in my day. Eat it, you say you're hungry, eat it. But you wet, you dry your pants, and everything is just wonderful. Everything, you start to crawl, and look at baby. Pulled over the lamp. How strong. Next year, But for a while, the world is my baby. I'm the focus of everything. Whenever I have a want, and isn't it a shame, it just comes when you don't understand, you don't realize it, but just the way I'd like to have it now, it isn't. And just one day, you go into a little room, perhaps your living room or somewhere, and there's another little child who up to then was the center of his universe, and you hear the beginnings of life. Mine. Mine. And the battle of life begins, never to end, ever, till you die. You discover you are in the world with a bunch of selfish, stinking, lousy people who think their needs are as tough as yours or as important. And as you grow up, you learn that you must give to get. You have to play games with people. You must disguise your real wants. You have to say, gee, Ma, You're sure pretty. That's such a pretty dress, Ma. Can I have a dime to go to the show, Ma? All the little games that go into growing up and disguising things. And it's a funny thing, really, the maturing process, to all intents and purposes. The maturing process is really a continuing process to disguise what you really feel. You call yourself mature when you don't show your emotions on a continuing basis. You grow up, and people grow up. You have these emotions inside, the basic visceral emotions, and the abilities on the outside that enable people to live in a society without living in a cave and eating people's clubs. You know, the world, we talk about honesty, the world could never exist with honesty. My wife says, what do you think of this dress? I think it's grotesque, for Christ's sake. What? I've learned to say, interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. And it goes on all the time. Bosses say, got that idea? Sure do. First law of survival in the business jungle, a little brown on the nose puts a little gold in the pocket. And you can poo-poo that in the abstract, but that's the real world in action. And so people grow up in the world. But they're still motivated. But all things being equal, I think it's safe to say, unless they're really unusual or psychotic, you wind up always the same thing. My wishes and needs are more important to me than your wishes and needs are to me. Nothing personal. Right? I can see that I need it and want it more than you do. You could get along without it. I need it. That is why you find people, rich, successful, wonderful people. You went through the other way from the airport again and again. Stoplights. Why do they have stoplights? Because adult, mature people all are convinced it is more important for me to get through that intersection than you. And you wait. What? So society had to say, now you children in the Lincoln, wait your turn and let the little boy in the caddy come through for a while. Okay. Now you, just like a grade school, just hideous. Because left for devices, I want what I want! I can't think of a single major law that is not directly or indirectly designed to protect someone or something from being used by someone or something else for their own purposes. The whole world is, I want what I want, and it may be what you have, and I'm sorry for you. You learn to get along without it, and you'll be happy that I'm enjoying it so much. People sometimes feel people are against them. I spent a lot of my life feeling people were against me. I've come to believe that as a rule, people are never against people. It is in some way that I am a threat to what they want. I am in their way. I threaten them in some way. I'm in somebody's way. If I step out of their way, they're not concerned about me. When people threaten me psychologically or financially or in my way between what I want, then I see them as against me, but not, or they see me as against them. I see people against me. And when I realize I am, they perceive me as a negative force. That's why they're against me. They're not against me because I'm clashy immigrant. They're against me because I'm between them and what they want somehow. So one of the great things to discover was for me is that when I'm not threatening the people, they don't feel threatened. If they, most of them will. Some people always will. But this concept of growing up is you always live with conflicts. Every human being has conflicts. There are a lot of conflicts. Because the world never is designed the way it should be. I get up in the morning and I feel good. And it's just, go to hell. Not my fault. Not every day. No. It will still get over that. But 99 days out of 100, yeah. And I think, things are happening to me. And it turns out things aren't happening to me. I get up in the morning and say, traffic jam. damn it! Another traffic jam! It screwed me up! Other days, when I'm feeling good, I say, a traffic jam. That happens. I can wait. It's as though there are different kinds of traffic jams. There are. There are just traffic jams. It's how I perceive them and how they are. But everybody lives with conflict, because what I want is not what you want to give me. And I got to give you something. The goal of life is to see how little do I have to give to get what I want. Whatever it might be, emotions, whatever it might be. This brings about continual conflict. It's an interesting thing. You know, these conflicts from driven to the extreme, when you become semi-goofy as a result of it, you commit suicide. I'll tell you something funny that you may or may not know. In my work today on Skid Row, I see people die regularly, sometimes every day. Die from alcoholism, die from crack addiction, which is a big new drug in the Skid Row community. That cheap crack, $3 a hit. See people die from hypothermia in the wintertime. People knife to death. That's another phenomenon in Southern California. Illegal aliens, they're frightened, they have knives. Some people get knives and these poor pathetic bastards cut into a line and somebody stabs them. See people fall in front of a bus and get run over, their head run over. See all kinds of deaths. But there's one type of death you never see on Skid Row. And it's misery and agony. There's never any suicide. Isn't that funny? You'd think that'd be the number one cause of death in all this agony. Why is there no suicide? Because they've given up the outside. They just have the inside. There's no outside. They don't have to pretend to feel differently than they do. You know, commit suicide? People who look like you and me. You get up every morning, no matter how you feel, you've got to suck it together. Go out there and smile at a dirty bastard you like to take an Uzi to. Hi, how are you? How have you been? How's the family? Yeah. Come home and have that beast nag at you, that unnatural children raising hell. Problems, money, don't. A lot of people have tools to diffuse that. We all do. But if you don't, it builds up. Continuing conflict can really push you into such a state of conflict that it overrides the most important instinct you have, which is self-preservation. I will finish self-preservation. And most of the tools that people like us have to live with is finding real ways to deal with conflict. Because on Skid Row, we talk about in AA, living one day at a time. That's where they live one day at a time. Every day is just it. You just get through today. It's a hell of a way to live, but they live in terrible pain and agony and filth, but no suicide, because at least they don't have to pretend. That's why it's almost impossible to take people off Skid Row and get them back in the world. Because they don't, if they ever had it, they've lost it. The ability to cope with a structured world that's full of conflict. All structured worlds are full of conflict. So, their conflicts are quite simple. Having something to eat, find a place to sleep. Very simple. There's no, have to worry about the report that's supposed to be in at 10 o'clock. But the only girl I've ever loved has gone back to her husband. Or on and on, all the various conflicts that go in the world. So we all have to deal with conflict. And that's what makes it so difficult, because each of us feel our conflicts, many times, feel are indigenous to us only. And that's what makes my case different. And that's why I think, and I've worked very hard to deal with conflict, and that's why I think Bill Wilson called step 6 the one that separates the men from the boys. Because now you have to be willing to give up defects of character. You've got to be willing to give up defects of character, and the defects of character are primarily tools you've used to help you cope with conflict. And I got to be willing to give them up. And it's a frightening thing, because I remember thinking, if I give up all those conflicts, if I give up all these defects of character, I'll become perfect. And AA says I don't have to be perfect. Chapter 5. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We seek progress, not perfection. And that's a it would be a bad step to take at this time, to become perfect. And if I do have to give up some things, let me decide the order I give them up, I'm going to give up everything. It's like we're talking at breakfast this morning about, after we're talking politics at breakfast, which you never want to do at breakfast, because I'm going to get that guy tonight. When he's sleeping, I'm like, for his own good, not for mine. But we're discussing about how politicians economize. They're all in favor of economy. Yes, I want economy. Yes, yes, yes. But we'll start with your district. My district needs what it's got. And that's the way it is with defects of character. I'm willing to give up defects of character. All of them. Lust? Well, let's start with murder. I'm going to give up murder. Then I'm going to give up. I'm going to give up piracy. I'm going to give up these things one by one, and I'm going to get to lust sometime later. But now they want us to make a commitment to give up everything. And we can't possibly give up everything. It always struck me that the sixth step is a very important step, because I must make a decision. Am I willing to give it up? I don't see how I can give it up, and if that maybe not happen in the foreseeable future, but I have to be willing to give it up. I have to sign an agreement in principle with the divine corporation saying, I'm not sure how we're going to tie it all together, but in principle, I'm willing to make the sale. I'm going to give it all up. And it's hard because there's a lot of things involved in giving up these things. And it entails a lot. It entails a lot of fear. My friend Sandy Beach in Washington uses a story a lot that I think entails. He talks about a little boy who wakes up in the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, he's got a toothache. And he knows that 2 aspirins will make it better. But he doesn't call for his mother. And at 3 o'clock, still aching. And at 4 o'clock, it's still aching. And finally he gets to bed, he says, Mother? He says, yes? I've got a toothache. Well, I'll get you 2 aspirins. And she brings him 2 aspirins. That's all right. Now the question is, why did he hold off? And the answer is very simple. The same reason we hold off when we deal with God, I think. He holds off because he knows there's going to be a hell of a lot more to it than 2 aspirins. The next morning she's going to say, Sonny, we're going to have to make a dental appointment for you. I don't want a dental appointment. My toothache's gone. Good thing to do. And you have to go to the dentist. And he's going to say, which tooth is sore? But he's not going to stop there. He's going to check all your teeth. He's going to find 8 more cavities. He's going to make 12 appointments. It's going to be endless goddamn horror and pain forever. It's easier to lie awake and see if that toothache will go away. No end to it. Same thing with these things. I will try to survive the pain of these defects of character a little while. Maybe they'll ease up. I hate to take it to God because God knows where it'll end then. You know, I might become perfect and become really a drag. There's a lot more to it than the 2 aspirins that you take. And that's what the fear is. The fear of the unknown. The fear that we're going to have to give up everything. I'm sure some of you felt this way. The only pleasures I have in life are my defects of character. I have to watch them, of course, but I mean, now you want me to give those up and go back to the very reason I drank. One of the reasons is because even with the defects of character, I was drinking, of course, life was just an endless gray tunnel. And that's what's wrong with AA. When you're new, you go to AA, and it's an endless gray tunnel. You give up whatever drinking, whatever technicolor there is, and you're going to be in this gray tunnel and become perfect for the rest of your life. And get little thin blue lips. And say, I don't believe I'd care to do that. That seems to be fun.